The morning Dorian Ashcombe, the 8th Duke of Marlowe, made his choice, the sky over his London townhouse was the colour of old tin. He stood at the tall window of his study and watched the rain slide down the glass in slow, wandering lines. The fire behind him snapped once and went quiet again. On his desk lay a letter, folded twice. The seal of the Earl of Penhallow broken cleanly down the middle. He had read it three times. He did not need to read it again. The letter said that the Earl's eldest daughter, Miss Vivienne Penhallow, was prepared to honour the agreement between their fathers. The letter said that the family welcomed his arrival at Renfield Hall on the appointed day. The letter said many polite things in many polite ways. The Duke did not believe any of them. He had been lied to before. He had been smiled at by mothers who counted his rooms before they counted their breaths. He had been courted by fathers who spoke of duty and meant debt. He had been kissed once, in a garden, by a woman whose laugh he had liked. And he had learned a month later that the laugh had been practiced in a mirror. He was 31 years old, and he had decided long ago that he would not be a fool twice. So he would not arrive as a duke. He would arrive as a man. He turned from the window. His valet, Miss Halsey, stood by the door with the patience of a man who had been standing by doors for 40 years. "The brown coat," the Duke said, "the one I wore in Yorkshire, and the boots that have been mended." "Mr. Halsey did not blink. Your Grace will travel as a traveller, a surveyor perhaps, a man hired by the estate to look at the drainage." He almost smiled. "I have been told the drainage at Renfield is poor." "Indeed, Your Grace, you will follow in 3 days with the carriage and the proper trunks. By then I will have seen what I need to see." "Mr. Halsey inclined his head a fraction. And if you are recognized, Your Grace?" "I will not be. I have not been to Cornwall since I was a boy. The Earl has not seen me in 12 years. His daughter has not seen me at all." He picked up the letter and dropped it into the fire. The paper curled and blackened and was gone. "If she is what they say she is, I shall meet her properly in 3 days, and we will pretend none of this happened. If she is not..." He did not finish. He did not need to. 2 days later, in a wet lane 6 miles from Renfield Hall, a man in a worn brown coat climbed down from a tired post horse and looked at a broken cartwheel with the expression of a man who had expected exactly this. The rain had stopped an hour ago, but the world was still dripping. The hedgerows smelled of crushed hawthorn and old rain. Somewhere a wood pigeon called twice and then thought better of it. The cart belonged to a baker's boy from the village. The boy was perhaps 14, with red hands and a face that had given up. The wheel had cracked clean through the spokes, and the loaves in the back were already going to be late. "Sir, I cannot pay you," the boy said, before the Duke had said a word. "I did not ask you to," the Duke said. He set his small leather bag on the verge, held the horse's head. He had not mended a cartwheel since he was 19 and stranded in the north, but his hands remembered. He worked in silence. The boy watched him with the careful eyes of someone who had been tricked before by kind-seeming men. The Duke noticed this and said nothing about it. He was tightening the last peg when he heard footsteps on the lane. Light steps. Quick. A woman's tread. But not a lady's. Or so he thought. Ladies did not walk in mud. "Tom," the voice said, gentle and a little out of breath. "I have your mother's basket. She thought you might be, oh..." The Duke straightened. The woman who had come around the bend was not what he had expected to see in a Cornish lane on a wet Tuesday. She was tall, but not tall enough to be remarked upon. Her hair was the colour of dark honey, pinned back without art, and a strand of it had come loose against her cheek. She wore a gown that had once been a pale blue and was now the colour of a sky that had been rained on too long. The hem was muddy. One of the cuffs had been mended, neatly, with a thread that did not quite match. She carried a covered basket on her arm and a shawl that had been knitted by someone who loved her and was not a skilled knitter. She was, by every measure his world had taught him to use, dressed in her worst dress. She did not curtsy, she did not flinch. She looked at the cart, and at the boy, and at him, in that order, and then she set the basket down on the grass. "Oh, Tom," she said. "Your wheel, a gentleman is fixing it, miss." She turned to the Duke. Her eyes were grey, the kind of grey that was almost green in certain light. She studied him for the length of one breath. Then she said, "With perfect ease. Thank you, sir. May I help?" He had been thanked by countesses and not heard it. He heard this. "You may hand me that peg," he said. She knelt in the wet grass without a thought for her gown and handed him the peg. Her fingers were cold. She smelled faintly of bread and lavender and something underneath that he could not name, something clean and small and warm. She did not look at his face. She looked at his hands. "You have done this before," she said. "Once or twice, not as a surveyor," he glanced at her then. She was looking at the wheel. Her mouth was serious, but her eyes were not. "I did not say I was a surveyor. Tom said a gentleman was fixing his wheel. Gentlemen in these parts who can mend a wheel are usually farmers' sons who have come up in the world. You are not a farmer's son." She lifted one shoulder. "Your boots have been mended, but they were good boots once. Your hands are clean under the dirt. And you speak as though you have read a great many books." "I have said 5 words to you, 6, she said. And it was enough. The Duke had not been spoken to in this manner by anyone since his old tutor died. He felt, very quietly, the first small crack in a plan he had thought was sealed. "I am a surveyor," he said. "I have been sent to look at the drainage at Renfield." "Have you indeed?" She did not sound convinced. She did not sound suspicious either. She sounded as though she had decided he was lying, and had decided also that it was not today her concern. "Then you must come up to the house when you are finished. We can give you a meal and a dry coat. The drainage at Renfield, sir, is very bad indeed. You will need your strength." She did not say her name. She rose, picked up her basket, brushed the grass from her skirt without looking down to see whether the brushing had worked, and held out her hand to the baker's boy. "Walk with me, Tom. We shall not wait for the cart. Your mother is worrying." The boy took her hand as a child takes the hand of someone he has known all his life. They went up the lane together, the muddy hem of her blue gown swinging gently against the wet grass. She did not look back. The Duke watched her go. He stayed kneeling by the wheel for longer than was needed. The wood pigeon called again, 3 times this time, and was answered. He had come to Cornwall to discover whether Miss Vivienne Penhallow was a woman he could marry without being a fool. He had imagined finding her at her toilet, or fussing over a piano, or speaking too loudly to a servant. He had not imagined finding her kneeling in the mud beside him, handing him a peg. He did not yet know that he had found her at all. He finished the wheel. He helped the baker's boy load the loaves back into the cart. He gave the boy a coin the boy tried to refuse, and the Duke said, quietly, "It is for your mother, not for you," and the boy stopped refusing. Then he picked up his bag, mounted his tired horse, and rode the last 6 miles to Renfield Hall, with his mind very busy and his face very still. Renfield Hall was a long grey house set against a long grey hill. It had been beautiful, once. It was still beautiful, in the way of a woman who has lived through a great deal and not let it bend her. The east wing needed slates. The west wing needed paint. The drive was rutted and the gates leaned, but the windows were clean and there were lights in 3 of them already, though the afternoon was not yet over. He gave his false name to a thin housekeeper with kind eyes. "Mr. Crane," he said. "A surveyor, come about the drainage." "You are expected, Mr. Crane," the housekeeper said, which startled him until he remembered that some letter had likely gone ahead from a real surveyor whose appointment he had taken over for the week. "Miss Penhallow said you were to be given the green room and a supper." "Miss Penhallow?" "The eldest, sir. Miss Vivian. She manages the house since her mother's illness." The housekeeper hesitated, then added, "She is the one who told me you would come. She said she had met you on the lane." He kept his face still. "Did she?" "Yes, sir. She said you were a man who knew how to mend a wheel and who lied about being a surveyor. She said we were to feed you anyway." The Duke laughed before he could stop himself. It was a short laugh, almost a cough. The housekeeper looked at him without judgment and showed him to the green room. He did not see Miss Vivian Penhallow again that night. He saw instead her younger sister. Miss Cecily Penhallow was 19, with hair the colour of new straw and a laugh that arrived before the joke. She came down to supper in a gown of pale rose that had clearly been new within the month, with a string of small pearls at her throat. She seated herself across from the Duke in the small dining parlour and looked at him in the way a cat looks at a curtain it intends, eventually to climb. "Mr. Crane, is it?" She did not wait for him to answer. What a curious profession. "Drainage. Do you find it interesting, sir, or is it merely a living?"
"Both, sometimes. Vivienne says you mended the baker's boy's wheel. She says you were quite gallant about it." Cecily's mouth made a small curve. "But then Vivienne says many things. She has a kind way of seeing the world. Father says it will be her undoing." The Duke set his spoon down. "Cecily, this came from the head of the table, where the Earl of Penhallow sat with the heavy slow look of a man whose health had left him some years before his title would. Eat your soup."
"Yes, Papa."
The Earl turned his eyes to the Duke. They were the eyes of a man who had once been clever, and was now only tired. "You are welcome here, Mr. Crane. I shall not pretend the estate is in good order. You will find what you find. My daughter Vivienne will show you the lower fields tomorrow. She knows the ditches better than my steward. God help us."
"Thank you, my lord, she knows them," Cecily said, smiling, because she walks them, in her oldest gowns, like a tenant's wife. There was a small silence. The Duke felt it move along his spine like a finger.
"That will do, Cecily," the Earl said, without force. But Cecily was not finished. She leaned forward a little, her pearls catching the candlelight. Her voice, when she spoke, was sweet and clear, and perfectly carrying.
"It is only that I worry, sir. We are expecting a very great visitor at the end of the week. The Duke of Marlowe himself, you understand. And Vivienne does insist on being seen in those dreadful old things. I have begged her to consider how it looks.
A duke, Mr. Crane, a duke, who has chosen her of all women, and she goes about looking as though she has been pulled through a hedge. I do not know what she means to wear when he arrives. Her best gown is 3 seasons old and has been turned twice. He will take one look at her and ride straight back to London." She said it lightly. She said it as though she were worried for her sister. The candlelight caught the pearls at her throat and the small perfect cruelty around her mouth, and the Duke understood, with a clarity he had not asked for, that Cecily Penhallow had been waiting weeks to say this sentence in front of a stranger, and that she would say it again to the next stranger, and the next, until somebody told her sister. He did not look at the Earl. He did not look at the empty chair where Vivienne should have sat. He looked at his soup, and he counted, very slowly, to 5, the way his old tutor had taught him to count when he wished to break something. "I am sure," he said, when he had reached 5, "that the Duke of Marlowe will think what he thinks. Whatever Miss Penhallow wears." "Oh, but a duke."
"A duke," the Duke said, "is only a man with too much land and not enough sense."
"I have known several." He picked up his spoon again. "The soup is excellent, my lord. My compliments to your cook."
Cecily's mouth opened and then closed. The Earl looked at the Duke with something like the first interest he had shown all evening. After supper, the Duke walked out into the garden alone. The rain had come back, very softly, more mist than rain. The smell of wet box hedge filled the air, sharp and green. He walked the length of the gravel path 2 times, and on the 2nd turn he saw a light in a window on the ground floor that he had not noticed before. It was the kitchen window. Through the small panes he could see Miss Vivienne Penhallow, still in the blue gown that had been rained on, sitting at the long scrubbed table with the cook and 2 of the maids. There was a great bowl of apples between them and a heap of paring knives. They were peeling apples. Vivienne was laughing at something the cook had said. The cook, a square woman with grey hair, was laughing too with her shoulders, the way old women laugh when they have known a girl since she was small. Vivienne reached across the table and put her hand for a moment on the cook's wrist. It was the smallest gesture. It said, "I know you are tired. I am here." The Duke stood in the wet garden and watched through the window for longer than he meant to. He did not know yet that he was watching the moment that would decide the rest of his life.
He only knew that something in his chest had gone quiet in a way it had not been quiet in years. He did not see her again until the morning. She came out to the stable yard at 7:30, in a different gown that was no better than the first. This one was grey, with the same neat mended cuff. Her boots were the boots of a woman who walked. Her hair was pinned the same way, and the same strand had come loose against the same cheek, as though it had decided that was where it belonged. "Mr. Crane," she said. She did not smile, but her eyes were not unfriendly. "If you are ready, I shall show you the lower fields." "I am ready, Miss Penhallow." She glanced at him then, briefly, with the same considering look she had given him on the lane. "You knew my name last night and did not say it." "I did not know it on the lane. You knew it by supper, I expect. Cecily would have made sure of that." He did not answer. She did not press. She turned and walked, and he followed. They walked for the better part of an hour. She named every field they crossed. She showed him a ditch that ran along the boundary of a tenant's holding, and had not been cleared in 3 years. She showed him where the stream had broken its bank twice last winter. She showed him the place where the old drain met the new, and where the new had been laid badly by someone who had been paid too much and supervised by no one. She spoke about drainage the way a doctor speaks about a fever, not lovingly, but exactly. "Who taught you all this?" he asked at last. "My father, when he was well. After that, the tenants. Mr. Hocking, who farms the lower 40, has been very patient with me." She paused on a stile and looked across at him. Her cheeks were pink with the walking. "Do I bore you, Mr. Crane?" "No." "You may say so if I do." "I have been told that I do." "Who told you that?" She lifted one shoulder. "It does not matter." He thought it did matter. He did not say so. They came back to the house by way of the kitchen garden. A small boy of perhaps 6 was sitting on the low wall, crying without sound, the way a child cries when he has been told he is too old to cry. His knee was bleeding through his stocking. Vivienne went to him as if she had been listening for him. "Joss, what have you done the wall? Miss, I fell off, of course you did. You will fall off it again next week." She sat down on the wall beside him, in her grey gown in the dirt, and pulled a clean handkerchief from her sleeve. The Duke noticed that the handkerchief had been embroidered along one edge by a hand much younger than hers. A child's stitches. Probably hers. 10 years ago. She had kept it. Hold still, she cleaned the knee. She tied the handkerchief around it. She did not promise the boy that it would not hurt, and she did not tell him he was brave. She told him that his mother would scold him and that he must let her, and that afterward he could come to the kitchen and Mrs. Polwell would give him a piece of the apple cake from last night. "Yes, miss." "Off you go," the boy went. The Duke stood very still. She rose, brushing her skirt, and looked at him with a slight question in her face, as though she were waiting to see whether he would say something foolish about the gown. He said nothing. They walked the rest of the way back to the house in silence. It was a comfortable silence, the kind that does not need to be filled. He had not known that silences could be comfortable. At the door, she paused. She turned to him. "Mr. Crane, Miss Penhallow, I do not know what you have come for. You have not come for the drainage, though you have been kind enough to listen as though you had." She did not look away. "If you have come to laugh at us, please do not stay long. We have had a hard year, and I have not the strength for it. If you have come for something else, I do not need to know what, then I ask only that you be honest when you can be." He felt something move behind his ribs that he did not have a name for. "I will try," he said. She nodded once and went inside. He stayed away from the house for the rest of that day. He walked the lanes. He spoke with 2 tenants who did not know him and were therefore honest in the way tenants are when they do not know who is listening. He learned a great many things that no letter had told him. He learned that the Earl of Penhallow had been kind before his illness and was now only quiet. He learned that the steward had been stealing for 6 years and had not yet been caught. He learned that Miss Cecily had refused 2 perfectly good young men because neither of them had a title, and that the village had a name for her, which they would not say aloud to a stranger. and he learned that Miss Vivian, said the blacksmith's wife. Putting a hand to her heart without thinking about it, Miss Vivian had sat up 3 nights running with the smith's youngest when the child had the fever last spring, and had not told a soul, and the smith would walk through fire for her, and the smith was not a man given to walking through fires. That evening, the Duke wrote a letter to his solicitor in London. The letter was short. It said, "Investigate the steward of the Penhallow estate. There is something rotten. Do it quietly. Do not let the Earl know it came from me. Send me the result before the end of the week." He sealed the letter himself. He gave it to a boy in the village, with a coin, and told the boy to ride to the post at Truro and to mention no name. The boy nodded with the seriousness of a child given a man's task, and he rode. He did not tell anyone at Renfield Hall what he had done. He did not tell her. That night at supper, Cecily was sweet to him in a way that made his skin feel small. She had heard, evidently, that he had spent the day walking with her sister. She wished to know if Vivienne had been quite herself. She wished to know if she had been very tiresome about the ditches. She wished, also, to know whether the gown her sister had worn that morning had not been a little, well, was it not very grey for a young lady? She did not say cruel things this time. She said careful things, which were worse, because they invited him to agree. He did not agree. He spoke instead of the weather, and of a book he had read in the library that morning, and of the small church on the rise above the village, which was, he said, the most beautiful village church he had seen in some years. Cecily soon grew tired of him. Vivienne was again not at table. The Earl, by way of apology, said she was reading to her mother. The Duke understood, then, that the Countess of Penhallow was alive but bedridden, and that Vivienne had been the one keeping her alive, and that no one in this house, with the possible exception of the cook, knew quite what they would do without her. He did not see Vivienne that night. He saw her the next morning, in the library, when he came down early. She was already there, on a low stool by the window, reading. She had not noticed him come in. The sun was on her hair. There was a pen behind her ear that she had forgotten about. He stopped in the doorway. She turned a page. Then she lifted her hand and touched the loose strand of hair at her cheek, and tucked it back without looking up. He had seen her do it twice already, on the lane and at the stile. It was, he realized, her small private routine. The thing she did when she thought no one was watching. The way some women adjusted their gloves and some women counted ceiling tiles. She tucked the strand back, and the strand, having loved her for years, fell forward again, and she did not mind. He stood in the door for the length of 3 breaths. He did not breathe in any of them. Then he stepped back, very softly, into the corridor, and let her have her morning unwatched. That afternoon, the second letter came. It came from his solicitor, by an express rider, and it confirmed what the Duke had already begun to suspect. The steward of Renfield was a thief. He had been a thief for 6 years. He had taken several £1,000s. The Earl, in his illness, had not noticed. The eldest daughter had noticed, but had not been able to prove it, because the steward had taken care that all the paper was in his own hand. The Duke read the letter twice. He folded it. He put it in the inner pocket of his coat. Then he walked out to the stable yard and asked a groom where the steward might be found. He was told that the steward had gone into Truro for the day and would not return until the morning. Good, the Duke thought. That gave him a night to think. He thought all that evening. He thought through the supper, where Cecily flirted with him because she had nothing better to do. And the Earl spoke twice, and then was quiet. He thought through the long walk in the dark garden. He thought through the hours after midnight, sitting at the small writing desk in the green room, the candle burning low. He had 2 choices. He could keep his disguise, he could see this thing through as Mr. Crane, he could expose the steward through a letter, anonymously, and ride away from Renfield Hall before the real Duke of Marlow was due to arrive. Then he could arrive properly, 2 days later, in his black coat and his good carriage, and meet Miss Vivian Penhallow as a stranger, and let her be furious with him when she discovered, eventually, that he had come earlier in disguise. Or he could end the disguise now. Tomorrow, before the steward returned. He could tell her who he was and let her be furious sooner and stand inside her fury and not look away. He thought of her face on the lane, asking only that he be honest when he could be. He wrote out the letter to the magistrate at his desk with the evidence of the steward's theft in his own hand. He sealed it. He set it aside. Then, just before dawn, he stopped pretending to himself that he had not already chosen. He went down to breakfast in the brown coat one last time. She was there. She was alone at the small table by the window. She had a cup of tea in front of her and a piece of bread she had not touched. The morning light was on her cheek. "Miss Penhallow, Miss Crane, I need to speak with you." "Not here," she looked at him. She set the tea down very carefully. "The library," she said. "In 10 minutes. I shall send the maid away." He went to the library. He waited. He did not sit. He stood by the window and watched the rooks lift off the elms and settle again, and he counted them, the way his old tutor had taught him to count when he wished not to break something. She came in. She closed the door behind her. She did not sit. She stood with her back against the door, the way a person stands who is not certain whether she will need to leave quickly. "Speak," she said. He drew the breath. He let it out. "My name is not Crane. I am not a surveyor. I am Dorian Ashcombe. I am the 8th Duke of Marlow. I came here 3 days before I was expected because I have been lied to too many times in my life, and I wish to see, for myself, what kind of woman my father had promised me to. I am sorry. I should not have done it. I have done it." He stopped. He waited. She did not move at first. The color went from her face very slowly, like the color going out of cloth in the sun. And then it came back again, all at once, in 2 hard spots on her cheekbones. "You." "Yes." "You." Her voice was very quiet. It was worse than a shout. "You came into my father's house in another man's name. You sat at my father's table. You let my sister speak in front of you as though you were nothing. You let me show you the ditches. You let me kneel in the mud and hand you a peg. You let me." She broke off. She pressed her hand against her mouth for an instant, then took it away. "You let me wear this dress in front of you, and you knew." "Yes." "You knew, yes. And what did you see, Your Grace?" The title came out of her like a thrown stone. "Did you see what you came to see? Was I sufficiently shabby? Was I sufficiently rustic? Was my sister sufficiently amusing? Was the soup sufficiently stop? Do not tell me to stop, I will not." He stepped toward her once and then did not step again, because she had flinched, very small, and he had seen it. "You may say anything to me. You may say it for as long as you wish. I will not leave this room until you have said all of it. But do not, do not believe for 1 second that what I saw in this house was anything other than what I am going to tell you now. I saw a woman who knelt in the mud to help a baker's boy. I saw a woman who has been running an estate that is failing because a thief is bleeding it dry. I saw a woman whose sister insults her in front of strangers and who does not insult her back. I saw a woman who keeps a child's handkerchief in her sleeve because it was her own 10 years ago and she does not throw small things away. I saw a woman who tucks back a strand of her hair when she reads and does not mind that it falls down again. I saw." He stopped. He had not meant to say so much. His voice had gone strange. "I saw the woman I am going to marry, if she will have me. And if she will not, I shall still have come earlier than I was meant to, and I shall not regret it." She was crying now, without sound, the way she had taught the boy to cry. Her hand had gone back to her mouth. She was shaking very slightly, though the room was warm. "You had no right," she said through her fingers. "I had no right. I know it. You had no right to see me before I was ready to be seen. I know it. Do you understand what you have done?" Her hand fell. Her eyes were wet, but her voice was steadier now, harder, the way iron is harder after it has been in the fire. "I have spent 6 months preparing myself for the Duke of Marlow. I have written out in my head 100 times the things I should say. I have planned which gown I should wear. I have planned how I should walk into the room. I have planned, because I had to plan, because I knew that if I was not perfect on the day, my sister would make sure that you, that he, that you, heard of every imperfection for the rest of my life. And you came in the back way, like a thief, and you stood in the lane and watched me kneel in the mud. Yes. Say something other than yes. I cannot say anything other than yes, because everything you are saying is true. She stared at him. She breathed in. She breathed out. Then she did the thing he had not expected. She laughed. It was a small laugh, and not a happy one, but it was a laugh, and it surprised her as much as it surprised him. She put her hand against the door behind her as though for balance. "You are the worst man I have ever met," she said. "I know. And you are the most honest one." He did not answer that. She closed her eyes for a moment. When she opened them, she looked tired. "Go away, Your Grace, Vivienne. Go away. Not from the house. From this room. I cannot speak to you any more this morning. I need an hour. I need to sit in the kitchen with Mrs. Polwell and peel something. Please," her voice broke on the please, and she steadied it. "Please," he went. He went without arguing. He went down the corridor and out of the front door and around the side of the house, and he walked, and he did not stop walking until he had reached the top of the hill above the village. And he stood there with the wind in his hair and the sea a long grey line in the distance, and he let her have her hour. When he came back, the steward had returned from Truro. The Duke walked into the Earl's small study without knocking. The steward was there, with a ledger open between him and the Earl, and the Earl was nodding the slow nod of a man who has stopped following the words. The Duke shut the door behind him. "My lord," he said. The Earl looked up. So did the steward. The steward's face changed very slightly, not enough for the Earl to see, but enough. "Missa Crane," the Earl said, "is there. My name is not Crane, my lord. My name is Dorian Ashcombe. I am the Duke of Marlow." The Earl sat very still. His hand on the ledger did not move. Behind him the steward had gone the colour of old paper. "I have arrived early," the Duke went on, "for reasons of my own, for which I have already apologised to your daughter, and for which I shall apologise to you. But I have not come to speak of that. I have come because your steward has been robbing you for 6 years, and I have the proof of it in my pocket. And the magistrate at Truro has been informed. I am sorry, my lord. He will be taken into custody before the day is out." The steward had risen. He was a thin man with a face that had once been pleasant. His mouth opened. "That is a lie. It is not a lie. I have your ledgers. I have your false receipts. I have the names of the three tenants you overcharged last quarter, and the miller in Truro, who has been buying your stolen grain at half its price." The Duke did not raise his voice. He did not need to. "Sit down, sir." The steward sat down. The Earl had not moved. He was looking at the ledger as though it had bitten him. After a long moment he lifted his head and looked at the Duke, and there was the ghost of the man he had been 20 years before in his eyes. The man Dorian Ashcombe's own father had liked. "6 years," he said. "Yes, my lord, my daughter knew. She suspected, my lord. She could not prove it." He kept the books in his own hand. The Earl closed his eyes. When he opened them, they were wet. He did not let them spill. "Thank you, Your Grace. There is no need, there is every need." The Earl looked at the steward. He spoke to him for the first and last time. "Get out of my study, Mr. Pello. The constable will find you at your lodgings within the hour. Do not run. I will know if you do, and I will pursue you, and I shall not be kind." The steward got up. He looked once at the Duke, and once at the Earl, and then he went out, and his step in the corridor was not the step of a man who had ever been confident at all. The Earl looked at the Duke for a long moment. "You are early, Your Grace. I am, my lord. My daughter has spoken to you, she has, my lord. She is, justifiably, very angry with me." "Yes," the Earl almost smiled. It was a tired smile and a very small one. Yes, she would be. The Duke bowed and left him. He did not see her again until the evening. The house had moved by then, in the strange way houses move when a great thing has happened in them. The servants spoke more quietly. The maids did not giggle on the back stairs. The cook, Mrs. Polwell, when he passed the kitchen door, looked at him without smiling, but also without dislike, and the Duke understood that she had been told some of it, and that she had not yet decided what she thought of him, and that her decision would matter. Cecily was not at supper. She had gone to bed with a headache, the housekeeper said, in a voice that meant Cecily had gone to bed in a fury. The Duke understood this too. Cecily had learned, no doubt within the last 3 hours, that the man she had insulted her sister to was the Duke of Marlowe himself. The thought did not give him the satisfaction it might have given a smaller man. It only made him sorry for Vivienne, who would have to live in this house with this sister for whatever time still remained before the wedding, if there was to be a wedding at all. He ate alone with the Earl. The Earl was quiet, but it was a different quiet than before, the quiet of a man who had been given back a part of his life he had thought lost. They spoke a little of the estate. The Earl said he hoped his daughter would forgive him. The Duke said he hoped she would forgive him too. The Earl looked at him then, with the ghost of the clever man returning, and said, "She will, Your Grace. She is harder on herself than on anyone else. Give her time." After supper the Duke went out into the garden again. He did not expect to find her. He found her. She was sitting on a low stone bench beside the box hedge, in a shawl, in the dark. The mist was back. He could see the shape of her, and the pale of her face turned away from him. She did not turn when he came up. "Sit down, Your Grace, Vivienne, sit down," he sat. He left a careful space between them. The bench was cold through his coat. The box hedge smelled sharp and green and slightly bitter, the way it had smelled on his first night. "You caught the steward," she said. "Yes, you wrote to the magistrate the day you read the letter from your solicitor." "How?" "Mrs. Polwell saw the boy ride out with your letter. The blacksmith's wife saw him come back with the answer. We are a small village, Your Grace. You did not hide it as well as you thought." He did not know what to say to that. "You wrote the letter," she said, "before you told me who you were, before you knew whether I would speak to you again. You did it because you saw a thing that was wrong and you fixed it. You did not do it to win me. You did it because you would have done it for anyone in this house. Anyone at all." "Yes." I asked the cook, this afternoon, what kind of man you had been at her table when she was in the room, whether you had been rude, whether you had been false. She was still not looking at him. She said you had been a man who had spoken to her as though she were a person. She said you had asked her once about her son in the Navy, and that you had remembered his name when you saw her the next morning. She said no gentleman in 20 years had remembered her son's name. Her voice was very quiet. "I did not know you had done that. It is not a thing one mentions, no," she said. "It is not," the mist moved. A blackbird, somewhere in the hedge, said one small sleepy note and was silent. "I am still very angry with you," she said. "I know. I shall be angry with you for a long time, I know. You should have come as yourself. You should have trusted my father. You should have trusted me." "Yes. But," she stopped. She turned her face toward him at last. In the dark her eyes were only a paler grey, almost silver. "But if you had come as yourself, I would have worn the wrong gown, and I would have said the wrong thing, and I would have spent my life wondering if you had chosen me because I had been perfect on the day, and I would never have known whether you would have chosen me as I am." He did not answer. He did not trust his voice. "So tell me," she said. "Tell me, Your Grace, what was it? You said in the library this morning that you had seen the woman you would marry, if she would have you. You said many things. You said too many things. But you did not say which one. Which moment? I have been thinking about it all afternoon, and I cannot decide, and I do not wish to decide for you. Tell me." He thought about it. He thought about her on the lane with the peg in her hand. He thought about her at the kitchen table with her hand on the cook's wrist. He thought about her at the stile, with the wind in her hair, naming every field. He thought about her with the boy on the wall, tying the handkerchief around the bleeding knee. He thought about her in the library window, tucking back the strand of hair that did not wish to stay. "It was the handkerchief," he said. The handkerchief, the one you used on the boy's knee. The one in your sleeve. You had embroidered it yourself, when you were a child. The stitches were small and uneven. You had kept it for 15 years, and you used it to bandage a knee that would heal in 3 days. I watched you do it, and I thought, she does not throw away small things. She does not throw away the boy. She will not throw away me, when I am old, and I am tired, and I have nothing left to give but my old self. His voice was very low. I am tired, Vivienne. I have been tired for a long time. I would like very much to be in a house where small things are kept. She did not speak. He felt her shoulder, on the bench beside him, very slowly, lean against his. It was not a great gesture. It was the smallest of gestures. It was the weight of a strand of hair tucked back. They sat like that for a long time, in the dark, in the mist, with the box hedge sharp around them and the blackbird asleep in the hedge. After a while, she said, "You are not forgiven yet, no. You will have to earn it, I know. I shall be very specific about how. I should like nothing better." She almost laughed. He felt the breath of it against his shoulder. "One thing first," she said. "Yes?" "My sister, yes. I shall handle her myself. You will not handle her for me. You will not speak to her on my behalf. You will not even look at her in a way that lets her know you heard what she said at supper. She is my sister. She is mine to deal with. Yes, and when I deal with her, you will stand beside me. Not in front of me. Beside me. Do you understand the difference, Your Grace?" "I understand it, Vivienne." "Good." She did not move away from his shoulder. He did not move away from hers. The mist thickened gently around them, and beaded on the box hedge, and on the wool of her shawl, and on the brown coat that he would never wear again. 3 days later, the Duke of Marlowe was formally received at Renfield Hall. He arrived in the black coach he had sent for. He wore the coat he had ordered new in London the month before. Mr. Halsey, his valet, walked behind him with the great trunks. The Earl, dressed in the best coat he still owned, came out to greet him on the steps, and so did the housekeeper, and so did the maids, and so did Mrs. Polwale, the cook, who had been allowed up from the kitchen for the occasion, and who looked at the Duke with the small approval she gave only to people she had decided to forgive. And Cecily was there. Cecily had been waiting for this morning for 6 months. She wore the new gown her father could not afford. She wore the pearls. Her hair had been done that morning by the maid, who only did it on great days. She stood beside her father on the steps with the bright, expectant face of a young woman who believed that today was the beginning of her sister's good fortune, and that her sister's good fortune would soon become her own. Vivienne stood on the other side of her father. She wore the grey gown. It was the same gown she had worn on the lane. The hem had been brushed clean. The cuff had been mended again. The strand of hair at her cheek had come loose, on purpose this time, because she had decided that was where it belonged. She was not pale. She was not afraid. She stood beside her father and waited for the man she had already met to step out of the coach in his black coat and pretend he had never seen her before. He stepped out. He climbed the 3 steps. He bowed to the Earl. He bowed to Cecily, who curtsied very low. He turned to Vivienne. The yard was full of people. The grooms had stopped working. The maids had come to the door. The cook stood with her hands folded. Cecily was watching with the small bright smile of a person waiting for a particular moment, and the particular moment she was waiting for was the moment when the Duke of Marlowe would look at her sister's grey gown and his face would change. The Duke looked at the gown. His face did not change. He took Vivienne's hand. He bowed over it. He straightened. He did not let it go. "Miss Penhallow," he said. His voice carried perfectly across the yard, the way a voice carries when its owner has decided it should. "Forgive me. I should have come earlier. I almost did. I shall be plain with all present, because plainness is owed in matters of this kind. Your father and mine, many years ago, made an arrangement. It is no secret. The whole county knows it. I came here today expecting to honour the arrangement out of duty. I had not expected to honour it out of choice. A small silence had begun to spread. The grooms had stopped pretending not to listen. The maids had stopped pretending not to listen. Cecily's smile had begun to lose its edges. The Duke did not look at Cecily. He looked at Vivian. His thumb moved once, over the knuckle of her hand, very small, where only she could feel it. "I have, since arriving in this county, had the great fortune to meet your daughter, my lord, in circumstances I shall describe to you in private. I shall say only this in public. I have seen Miss Penhallow at her work. I have seen her with tenants who cannot pay, and with children who have skinned their knees, and with servants who are tired, and with a baker's boy whose cartwheel was broken in the lane. I have seen her in the gown she wears today, which I am told by certain persons in this house is her worst. I do not find it her worst. I find it the gown of a woman who has been holding this house together with her own two hands for longer than anyone in this house has thanked her for." A small sound came from Cecily. The Duke did not look at her. "I have come here," he said, still looking at Vivienne, "to ask, with the permission of her father, and with no obligation upon her whatsoever, whether Miss Vivienne Penhallow will do me the honour of marrying me, not because of any arrangement, because of what I have seen with my own eyes. I will wait as long as she needs to answer. I will accept whatever answer she gives. And I will say, before all of you, so that none of you may ever forget I said it, I would marry her in that gown tomorrow, in the village church, with no settlements and no carriage and no London season, and consider myself the most fortunate man in England." The yard went silent. It was the kind of silence that has a shape. The grooms had not moved. The maids had not moved. Cecily's mouth was open, and she had not yet decided to close it. The Earl was looking at his daughter with an expression that the Duke would remember for the rest of his life. Mrs. Polwale, the cook, had her hand against her own mouth, and her eyes were full. Vivienne did not let go of his hand. She looked at him for a long moment. The strand of hair at her cheek lifted a little in the small wind off the hill, and then settled. She did not tuck it back. She let it be. "Your Grace," she said. Her voice was perfectly clear. It carried as well as his had. "I will marry you. I will marry you in this gown. I will marry you in the village church. And I will say, before all of you, so that none of you may ever forget I said it, that he came to me first as a stranger in a worn brown coat, in a wet lane, and helped a baker's boy whose cart had broken, and asked nothing of me. And I gave him a peg, and I think perhaps that is the only kind of beginning that has ever been worth anything." The silence held one beat longer. Then Mrs. Polwale began to cry, quietly, into her apron. One of the grooms, who was very young, cheered before he could stop himself, and then went red to the ears. The Earl reached for his daughter's other hand and held it. Cecily was very still. She would have things to say, later in private to someone, but she would never again have them to say in front of a stranger about her sister's gown, because the stranger had heard her, and the stranger had been the Duke. They were married in the village church 4 weeks later. Vivienne wore the grey gown. She had been offered three new ones by three different aunts, and had refused all of them with the same small smile. The cuff had been mended one final time, by Mrs. Polwale herself, with a thread that almost matched. The strand of hair came loose during the ceremony, and the Duke, very quietly, when he took her hand to put on the ring, lifted his own hand and tucked it back behind her ear. He did it without thinking. He did it as though he had been doing it for years. They came home to a house in Devonshire that he had not lived in since he was a boy. It was smaller than Marlow, and warmer. He had chosen it for that reason. She liked it at once. She walked through the rooms with her hand trailing along the backs of chairs, and she said, in the kitchen, "Oh, there is a south window," in the voice of a woman who had been hoping for a south window all her life. A year later, they were sitting in that kitchen, very early in the morning, before the household was up. There was a fire in the grate. The smell of coffee was in the room, and the smell of bread that had not yet been put in the oven, and the smell of lavender from a small jug on the table. Vivienne was at one end of the long scrubbed table mending a cuff. It was not her cuff. It was his. He was at the other end, reading a letter from his solicitor about the drainage at Renfield, which was finally being done properly, with money from his own purse, which the Earl had stopped trying to refuse. Vivienne lifted her hand and tucked the strand of hair behind her ear. She did not look up from the cuff. The Duke set the letter down. He watched her for a long moment. "What?" she said, without looking up. "Nothing," he said. She smiled at the cuff. The fire snapped once and went quiet. Outside, very far off, a baker's boy's cart could be heard on the lane, the wheels turning steadily, the small bell on the harness ringing once at the bend. Vivienne tucked the strand of hair back again. It fell forward again. She did not mind. He did not mind. The morning went on. Thank you for staying with this story until the very end. If this moved you, please like, share, and subscribe. Your support keeps these stories alive.